still remember when I was in high school going to a funeral. It was a family member on my dad's side. I remember not knowing anything about the person who had passed and considering to myself if I knew anything about any of the people involved. And I remember sitting in the church looking at the different people that had come to the funeral, thinking to myself, I wonder how many of these people I'm actually related to. Short answer was most of them. I didn't know that at that time. I also remember my sister was the cantor for the funeral. She was going to school at the University of Chicago at the time, so she was nearby and was able to cantor for it. And it was fascinating to me because we got to the luncheon afterwards, and we're actually more on the way to the luncheon. I asked my father, you know, who these people were, and my dad started listing off various people, and I said, why don't we know any of them? I mean, I don't know them, I don't know their names, I don't hear about them. My dad said, well, we'll figure it out later. You know, there's apparently a lot more to the story than we had for the 4 minutes driving over to luncheon. But, you know, we made our way over, and it was incredible, because when we got there, everyone came over to my sister. They were so excited to see her. They were so excited, basically, to meet her for the first time, many of them. I mean, they'd heard about her once or twice. But what fascinated me was that this particular group of the family, they had isolated from us for a number of reasons. There were, of course, racial biases. You know, the fact that I'm Scotch-Irish-German does not mean that we all speak to each other. It just means that we have three groups of family who sometimes don't speak to each other ever. But largely, it was fascinating because in so many ways, they created distance intentionally because they saw my parents as irresponsible. They did. It was amazing to me. My dad had been in seminary, and in college seminary he left, which, by the way, happens a lot. It's really okay. Left in seminary. It was part of the discernment process. Some of them never forgave him for that. And then he got married, which was okay, you know, but, you know, after his second child, he didn't stop. He had a third kid, and that was kind of irresponsible of him. And then he had a fourth child, which was just a crime against nature. And then he had a fifth child, which made him just a monster. And by the time he had that sixth kid, they had nothing to do with us. I mean, we were this irresponsible, fringe, psychotic group that had gone off. And then we moved out of the city, which was just the capital sin. There was no more to do with us. They wanted nothing to do with us. They wanted no interest. They were completely done with us. Until we have this funeral, and my sister stands there, a talented, pretty girl in college, on a scholarship, and in so many ways, had so many gifts to offer, so many remarkable and wonderful traits. And in fact, I still remember as they were hearing about all the things that my sister could do, it was kind of fascinating to me because one of my dad's cousins came over to him and said, so does your daughter, is she working on like levitating or telekinesis on top of it all? I mean, it was just one of these, it seemed like her gifts were endless. And it was just mounting praise on praise and just one talent after another. I, by the way, was a lower classman in high school, so I was a child and that was not acceptable, so I was to be relegated to a dark corner somewhere where they could neither see nor hear me, because children are not seen nor heard. They are a nuisance and they should be removed from life, apparently. I was fascinated by the concept. I tried to explain to them someone to pay their social security, but apparently that was not the okay sentence at that time. But they loved my sister. They were so excited. Look at the town, look at the college, and sings, and all these beautiful, wonderful things. And I even remember hearing I found out later, was a great aunt or a great great aunt standing next to my sister saying, you know, we're going to sit next to each other at lunch, and you know, we're going to become good friends, and you know, we're going to become fast friends. This is going to be great. And her husband made the comment. He said, why do you care now? You didn't care about her for the first 20 years of her life. Apparently he likes sitting on the couch. I don't know. Apparently that had just been a lot in life and he just accepted it. I still remember all the air exiting the room for a brief moment as everyone gasped in harmony sort of make that void of oxygen in that brief moment. But it really spoke to something remarkable. And it did. It spoke to something quite remarkable in that we have this family. These are our family members to this day. Today, I was in high school at the time. Today, I still don't know these people. I still haven't spoken to them. I did invite them to my ordination. They didn't care. I invited them to first mass. I was not ordained in Chicago, so I was dead to them. So they were done with that. I mean, Apparently there is no life outside Chicago. Don't tell them that. So, you know, don't tell them Dixon Illinois exists. It'll completely ruin their worldview. I'm fascinated by this because as I was looking at it, I was really considering what we celebrate today in the Epiphany, because what we have is this remarkable moment where we have a people particularly set aside for God. That's what he calls it. He mentions it in the prophet. He says, "You are a people peculiarly my own, set apart for God in a very special way. They are a chosen people. They are a family. They trace their lineage back by their blood. The family line means everything. It connects back to this chosen father Abraham. It means everything. And within this family, what are they waiting for? Why are they this chosen people? Well, they're a chosen people particularly because they're waiting for this Savior, this Messiah, this anointed one who is to come and bring them to the forefront of everything. That's what all of the prophets say, that this one is going to come and he's going to be their Messiah and they're going to become the forefront of everything. It is there on Mount Zion all the tribes are going to come up to them. The 12 tribes of Israel will be established as 12 ruling tribes of the whole land. And it all comes to fruition through this Savior. And they know where the Savior is supposed to be. And they have promises of what it's supposed to look like and how it's supposed to come about. And yet this family, who is waiting for this one Savior, needs strangers from a faraway land to show up at their door and say, "Where is your newborn king? Where is this great one you've been waiting for?" And do they react with joy? Do they say, within our own family, of course, it's here, we can see the signs, they're pointing to them. They see them, they observe them, we need to do something. No. No, instead they ignore him. Herod is interested because he's afraid he's going to lose his seat of power. He's afraid he's going to be somehow dethroned. He's already executed 4 of his sons for fear that they might try and take his throne away from him. I don't really know how he expects someone to succeed him at all, since he keeps executing any successor. But now he's panicked. He's afraid of a baby, because at one point it might dethrone him. It might take away this great seat of power. Realize that the scribes in Jerusalem, they even know where the child should be. Herod goes to them, he says, "Where is this kid? Where is this one that they're looking for?" And of course they go, "Well, come on, Herod, everybody knows that. He's in Bethlehem." They even quote the passage in verse. So he goes to the Magi, he says, "When did you see it?" They tell him the time, the date, the place, the whole nine yards. He says, "It's in Bethlehem, it's that way." But they don't go. Realize that the Magi go. The Magi who arrive, they head straight out. But the scribes, the learned, the ones who've been waiting their whole lives, for generations, for the arrival of this Messiah, they don't go. It's not according to the way they want it. Jesus isn't coming on their terms anymore. It's not coming the way that they expect. It doesn't fit into their worldview. It doesn't come the way that they think it should happen. And they ignore it. One of the things that fascinates me most of all about this Feast of the Epiphany, this great moment where these wise men from the East come and they present these remarkable gifts that speak to the kingship, the divinity, and the humanity of this great newborn king. What is remarkable above all of this is that the ones who are closest to it, the very family of God, they don't even see it. And it's right in front of them. What fascinates me is that as we celebrate the Epiphany, what we really should consider is the gifts within our own community, the gifts within our own family, the gifts that we have been given from God in so many ways, but choose not to see them. Because it didn't happen the way we wanted it to, because it doesn't come on our terms, because it doesn't arrive on our timeline, because it doesn't happen in the way that we want it to happen, and it doesn't happen right now, we reject the gift. We ignore what we've been given.
And instead, we look for something else. Something that fits better within our worldview. I want to challenge you as we continue this Christmas season, because don't forget, we are still in the Christmas season. Decorations don't come down this week. See the gifts that are presented to you. Consider for a moment that God has sent you many gifts, even if you cannot see them right now, even if you don't see them as such. See the hidden gifts in front of you, even if it takes an epiphany to understand them. And thank God for those many things that, even if we don't know them, are still in our midst and benefiting us.